would like at this point to introduce to you this evening our very distinguished guest speaker. Again, another unique facet about our connection here is the fact that usually I was not present at the bar mitzvah of our guest speaker, but I was present at Rabbi Ari Marburger's bar mitzvah many moons ago, and I still remember him growing up and seeing him literally blossom as a Talmud Chacham, as an individual who is very devoted to sharing the wisdom of our beautiful heritage with our brethren, and it's certainly been it's been a great inspiration to me personally. I want you to know that our topic tonight, as I think you all know, is the topic when Mount Sinai and Wall Street meet. We live in a world where I think many people are under the impression that Mount Sinai and Wall Street never meet. You know, the connection between Jewish ethics, Torah ethics, on the business front is for various reasons, not always readily apparent. And we are very privileged to be able to present Rabbi Ari Marburger, who has developed not only a national but an international reputation for his expertise in this area. Rabbi Marburger, he is the director of the Business Halacha Institute. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen many books published by Art Scroll. One very popular and a very important book, one of my favorites, is a book called Business Halacha. Rabbi Marburger is the author of that particular book. He is also, you wouldn't know it, usually you think of someone who's a judge on a rabbinical court, think of somebody with a long white beard, right? Rabbi Ari Marburger is a dayan, he's a judge on a rabbinical court. As a matter of fact, there's someone, fortunately, we do have people out there who, when it comes to conducting business, they really want to get it right. So there have been various corporate settings where people have, engaged Rabbi Marburger as a consultant. As a matter of fact, he's a consultant for a major hedge fund. Hedge funds and Jewish ethics don't sound like they go together too well, if you know anything about how hedge funds work. But there's one particular hedge fund that sought out Rabbi Marburger because they want to get it right. In any event, sometimes I will say about a speaker that I could tell you that where did they get their credentials? I'll tell you, which yeshiva they went to. I'll tell you sometimes which university they went to. I want you to know how Rabbi Ari Marburger became who he became. He went to the finest institutions. I'll tell you which institution. His grandparents, I knew. His grandfather was a businessman. He sold surgical supplies, and he was as straight as an arrow. Straight, honest, and this tradition was passed down to his kids. They are also individuals who has set an unbelievable example of business integrity. So Rabbi Marburger, he has a Masorah. He has a heritage of integrity and emes and truth and growing in the beautiful values of our wonderful Torah. Without any further ado, it is my great personal privilege to present to you Rabbi Ari Marburger.
Thank you, Rabbi Zaitchik, and just thank you to our host. As Rabbi Zaitchik mentioned, one of my more interesting day jobs is I'm a member of a Beis Din, a Bet Din in Lakewood. And what we do is, when there are two people who are involved in a dispute, whether it's a partnership, whether it's employer or employee situation, and they have a dispute, they need to resolve the dispute, And very often they will come to us, instead of going to court, instead of retaining an attorney and dealing with it and applying civil law, they want to apply halacha. They want to apply Jewish law to their disputes. And that's what we do. We hear the case, we have a panel of three arbitrators or three dayanim, and we apply Jewish principles to the dispute on hand. Now, tonight, I'd actually want to make one correction as far as what the advertisement was and what the lecture will be. The lecture was presented as when Mount Sinai meets Wall Street. I hope this does not turn out to be a lecture. I'm going to give some case studies. We'll discuss some actually scenarios that were presented to us. I will take certain poetic liberties with the cases, but I hope it turns more into a discussion than just a one-sided lecture. If anyone has any comments or any questions, or wants to shift the discussion a bit, please feel free to do so. I don't know the industries that everyone here is in, so again, I'll start with a few examples, but again, feel free to change the subject.
I have a question.
That was quick.
I'm just curious, when somebody comes before you and they don't abide by what you say, do they have to sign something beforehand?
Yes, before we'll take a case, we have them sign two documents. One is a Hebrew language agreement. It's called a Shtar Brurin. And that, from a religious point of view, they're accepting the authority of the Beis Din and agreeing to abide by whatever the award is. However, that will not get you very far in case a party refuses to listen. And for that, we have them sign a legal arbitration agreement. In the United States, an arbitration panel, a religious arbitration panel, presuming they follow certain basic guidelines, their award is enforceable. And 9 out of 10 times, anyone who's willing to come to a Beis Din, it's because they want to do what's right. And they may not like what the award is, but they generally listen without any problems. In the few cases where they've refused, where it's gone to court, they've challenged it, the court has always upheld it. So it is binding, it is something which is enforceable. You know, it's never pleasant to have to go through the process, but it is available if the need arises. Okay. So this is actually a true story. There was a developer that was working on a project. He actually spent years and years patiently putting together, buying parcel after parcel, until he had almost the entire area that he needed to redevelop this particular location. There was one lot, one strategically located lot, which he just couldn't get his hands on. The ownership wasn't clear. It was owned by an LLC. He couldn't really figure out who owned it. And he tried different ways to put in an offer. Nothing doing. Wasn't going anywhere. One day, he was in the shul, in the synagogue, praying. And at the end of the prayer, someone taps him on the shoulder, introduces himself, "Hello, my name is David Cohn. I know what you're doing with this redevelopment. I've been watching throughout the years as you bought one parcel after another, and I know you have plans to do something big. I'm the guy that owns that lot in the middle, and I'm not selling. You want the lot, you take me in as a partner. Here's my card, call me back when you're ready." The fellow didn't know what to do. He was, again, there. He invested tremendous amount of resources into the deal, and he was really stuck. He was this fellow had him over the barrel. So finally, he thought of a brilliant plan. The area that in question was a run-down, seedy area. This developer was very well politically connected. So he decided to approach the government and start lobbying them. They should seize this particular lot through the rights of eminent domain and sell it to him. This way, he'd be able to purchase the lot that he needs and move ahead with his development. Sounds like a brilliant plan. But before he went ahead and actually did it, so he picked up the phone, he called the Beis Din, and he wanted to know, is there anything wrong with doing this? Anybody have an opinion?
I would say going to the civil authorities to basically take a Jew's property away from him is probably a huge problem.
Okay, so that was actually his question. His concern was, can I go to a government and use them as a way to extort this property from another Jew? Now, I'm not convinced that's a problem. Because in this particular case, we're assuming this is a developer, he wasn't bribing anybody, there was nothing under the table. This was an area that was run down. It needed redevelopment. And we're assuming the government's actions were completely legal. Eminent domain is a right the government has. In a case like this, it was appropriate for them to exercise that right. So you can't really accuse him of extortion or grabbing something that he's not entitled to if the government had the right to take this property. I would suggest that this fellow is violating one of the Ten Commandments. Okay, little test. Who knows which is the tenth? Which is the last of the Ten Commandments? Coveting. What does it mean now? Coveting. Unfortunately, you know, don't steal. Don't murder. Those are things. The easy concepts. What does it mean not to covet? So, the way the Rishonim explain what that commandment means is if you see that someone else has something and you want that thing, you're coveting it, you're lusting for it, and you take action to force him to sell it to you, that is Lois Achmad. That is, you're violating one of the Aseres HaDibros, one of the Ten Commandments. Now let's take a step back. Everyone here is ambitious, right? Everyone goes ahead, you do business, you're constantly buying and selling. Where do we draw the line? What is okay, what is acceptable business practices, and when do we say, you're going too far, you're stepping over the line, this is called lust, this is called Lois Achmad. So the way the Rambam explains it is that if something's for sale, you have every right to buy it. You can negotiate, you can try to drive a bargain. I mean, you're Jewish. That's what Jews do. That being said, if the person does not want to sell it, and you are going ahead, you want his thing, you take action to pressure him to sell it against his will, that is Lois Achmad.
But this is a little different because there is such a thing as greater good. Mm-hmm. And you say this particular place was a rundown place, and like 90% he owned already. Mm-hmm. So doesn't it apply?
Okay, the greater...
That's usually where the eminent domain comes in, right? They do it, you know, for a highway or whatever it is.
Correct.
For the greater good.
Correct.
The
concept of the greater good is certainly a concept, but really just two observations. The first is that whatever the developer's motivation was, it wasn't for the greater good. It was for his good. He was trying to develop a property. His motivation was not, this area is run down, we need to improve it for the citizens. His motivation was, I want to put up this development, I can sell units at who knows how much, and that's what I'm out for. The second point
is...
it's
a side effect that area is going to be improved.
I would argue it's probably the other way around. The improvement was the side effect. The focus was the development.
Okay.
We can ask the developers in the room which one they think is really the motivating factor, but...
No, it's motivation. That's fine.
Okay, correct. Right, but your point is well taken. The second point is just a general observation, and you know, don't take this wrong. Most criminal activity or most really nasty things are done in the name of the greater good. You have to be very careful when a person goes ahead and does something which is in its face wrong because it's for the greater good. It's a justification which I'm not saying there is no place for it. There certainly is. But you really have to think long and hard. And generally, I would suggest that the person who benefits from it shouldn't be making that decision. If your neighbor decides, you know, it's for the greater good, someone's got to go ahead and redevelop it, I can deal with the argument. But if the person who has the most dollars to gain makes this decision that it's for the greater good, I would just be a bit skeptical. So going back to our discussion, Lois Achmad, you should not covet. What does it mean to covet? It means when you see something that someone else has, you're jealous of it, you want that thing, and you actually take action, you pressure him to sell it to you.
Isn't it also coveting what the other gentleman said, that he wanted half of his business by selling?
That's a great point. That's a great point. But what really happened is that fellow owns the lot. He's not ready to sell. If I make an announcement that I'm not going to part with my car unless someone gives me $100,000. Now it's rather unlikely I'll get a buyer. It's a 2008 Camry. Anyone who's interested, we can talk after the lecture. But if someone goes ahead and says, you know what, I'm willing to pay the price. If it's Rabbi Marver's car, hey, that's a bargain. Then you can't accuse me of being Lois Achmad because I'm just saying, listen, this is the law. I'm very happy with what I have. We can leave it the way it is. You want me to give this up, this is my price. In contrast, the developer was not happy with the status quo. He wanted what this fellow had, and he was going to go to great lengths to go ahead and make him sell it to him. Now, typically speaking, what comes out is, if someone, Leisachmoid is pre-limited, because they come out, your neighbor comes in one day to work with a new smartphone. Now, you might be jealous of it, you might be eyeing, you might really want it, but you don't want his smartphone. You're not going to go over to him and offer him $1,000 for the phone. What you do is you're going to go home, you go online, you're going to order your own. So that is not Leisachmoid, because you're not coveting what he has. You may like it, you may want it, but you don't want his. You just want another one of those items. You're not going to do anything to him or pressure him to try to obtain it. So today, where virtually everything is mass-produced, it's rather unusual for you to really violate this. The one case that it really comes up is in the context of real estate, where a person for some reason wants this particular property, whether he's developing, whether he has a family member, that he has elderly parents, he wants to buy a house for nearby, and therefore he's pressuring neighbors to sell the house. That is where this prohibition can apply. Now, as far as the definition of pressure, that's a little bit unclear. Certainly, if the fellow doesn't want to sell, and you tell him that, listen, if you don't want to sell, I have a buddy named Meatloaf who will be paying you a visit. That's clearly a case of, you've clearly stepped over the line. But if you really don't need to go to such an extreme length, the very fact that you're pressuring him, it's brought down even asking him three times. Once he's turned you down twice, he said, he's not interested. Just pestering him and nudging him, being a kvetch until he actually sells it to you, that is where the concept of Leisachmoid applies. Now, interestingly enough, that if a person wants the property, this fellow who made the phone call, he did not violate Leisachmoid, because the fact that you want it or you make plans, that itself does not rise to the level of Leisachmoid. What you need is you actually have to be successful. Had he gone through with his plans and taken that property for himself, then he would have been guilty of Leisachmoid. In this particular case, where he may have wanted it, he may have made a plan, but he didn't carry through, so he did not. It's not certainly not a nice thing to do, but he has not violated Leisachmoid yet, which means that at least in this area, sometimes it is good to be a shlamazel. Because if you're successful, if you pressure him and he actually sells it to you, you've violated one of the Ten Commandments. If you were unsuccessful, you pushed, you tried, but at the end of the day, you didn't obtain the property, then you did not violate Leisachmoid. Again, there are other issues, but Leisachmoid you would not violate. Now, how do we understand this idea? I think everyone, if we go around the room and ask, is it a nice thing to covet or be jealous of what someone else's possessions? I think we all could agree that it's not a nice thing to do. Are we on the same page on that? That being said, we're talking about the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are pretty basic and fundamental rules. You're not allowed to murder someone. That's one of the Ten Commandments. That's a pretty heavy issue. If you go around murdering, we have a serious problem. The other one is you can't kidnap people. That's also a very serious crime. Believing in God, that's another, what's one of the Aseret HaDibros. Leisachmoid, this coveting seems to be, it's not a nice thing to do. But does it really rise to the level that it's such a fundamental prohibition that it belongs in the Ten Commandments? So I believe the correct approach is the Rambam, when he explains the prohibitions, he says that a person starts off, he'll see something that someone else has, he'll want it. The next thing that he'll do is he'll start pressuring him to try to sell it to him. He'll try to violate Leisachmoid. If he's not successful, if the pressure doesn't work, he'll go ahead and he'll rob the person. And if while he's trying to steal it, if the owner fights back, if the owner resists, he may come to murder him. And therefore the Rambam writes, from Leisachmoid, from this small step of having this jealousy, you can come to murder. Now, realistically speaking, I don't believe the gentleman that called and asked the question, his next step was to pull out an M16 and go ahead and blow the fellow's brains out. That's not the way it works in real life. However, if you think about it, when people, we all unfortunately bump into people who are thieves, who are crooks, who have serious ethical and moral deficiencies. That doesn't happen overnight. People don't wake up one morning and just say, okay, I'm just going to wake up today and murder my neighbors. It just doesn't happen. What happens is that people start out straight. People start out trying to be honest and having a strong amount of integrity. But you go into business, and it's difficult. There are a lot of challenges. There are a lot of temptations. And what all too often will happen is a person on the margins starts cutting corners. On the margins, he feels he needs something so badly, and he's willing to make certain compromises. And over time, it's a slippery slope. The compromises get worse and worse and worse until you can reach the lowest level. And I think that's the Rambam's point. If we don't stop at that first level, if we allow people to want something so badly that they're ready to pressure and go to great lengths to get it from someone else, then the end result is he'll go step after step until he reaches a very low level. New York City had a very high crime rate. I mean, I'm from New Jersey. It's easy for me to talk. But how did they get it under control?
Broken glass, they called it.
Exactly. Zero tolerance. In the olden days, the police said, listen, we have murders going on right and left. Someone has graffiti. We can't be bothered with that. We've got to focus on the serious crimes. The little things are not so important. You know, we'll deal with that when we get to it. But at some point, the police realized that was the wrong approach. What you have to, when people are in gangs and murdering people, at that point, you're going to have a very hard time dealing with the issue and solving the crisis. But if you start with zero tolerance, the moment there's any graffiti on a wall, you arrest whoever did and any little thing, person steps out of line, you immediately confront him. You immediately stop him at that point. He'll never get to the level where he joined the gangs. You'll never get to the level where there are these murders happening. And it was a very successful change of tactic. And I think that is really the message of Lo Sachmoid. It's one of the Aseret HaDibros, it's one of the Ten Commandments, because we've got to start early, and we have to nip it in the bud. Let me go on to another story, a little bit, more of a... I heard it as a true story. You can use your judgment whether it actually happened or not. A fellow was traveling to California, which after a winter like this, I think we can all understand, is a pretty good idea. His neighbor told him, you know what, I have a sister in California. It's her birthday tomorrow. So do me a favor, I'd like to surprise her, a little gesture. Can you please bring a cake to her? Okay, a little bit of a strange request, but sounds pretty harmless. They weren't traveling light anyway, so they said, no problem. They took the cake. They got to the airport, and as airports go, the lines were terrible. They're sitting there waiting and waiting. They got delayed, and it was a whole... And at some point, they noticed that the cake already is starting. It's starting to melt. It's getting all messy and sticky. So he opens up the box. He sees the cake. Happy birthday, Rachel. So goes to close his garbage can, throws the cake in the garbage, jets off to California. When he touches down, goes to a local bakery, buys an identical cake, tells him to write Happy Birthday, Rachel on it, and he delivers the cake. Everything sounds fine and dandy. An hour later, he gets a frantic phone call. Where is the cake? He said, what do you want? They said, no, that wasn't the cake. My brother needed to send me money. There was $10,000 of cash in this cake. What happens next? So, in general, there's a fascinating discussion in the Talmud, where there's a concept of a shomer, of a guardian. You go away, you go on vacation, you have valuables, you don't want to leave them alone in the house. So you go to your neighbor, you knock on the door, say, here's my jewelry, can you watch it for me for the next few weeks? If he accepts, then if you agree to watch something, you're responsible for it. If anything happens to it, then you've got to pay for the damage. Now, if you're a volunteer, you're not getting paid, you're doing it as a favor. So you have a minimal responsibility. You can't be negligent. You have to put it in the house. You have to lock it. You have to make sure everything is okay. As long as you weren't negligent, you're off the hook. On the other hand, if you leave the door open, or for that matter, if you allow your cleaning lady or your domestic help to have access to this room where they can just walk off with it, that would probably be negligence. So in that case, you would have to pay. If you're careful, you're off the hook. The Gemara deals with a case, a very similar case, where a neighbor was going away. Now they knew, if they would tell a neighbor, listen, I'm going away for a week, can you please watch my jewelry, it's worth $50,000. The neighbor would say, $50,000, I don't want to take this kind of responsibility. So instead, what they did is, can you watch my jewelry? It's just some costume jewelry. It's worth a couple hundred bucks. The neighbor accepts the jewelry and is negligent. The item gets stolen. How much do they have to pay? So here the Talmud says that you only have to pay a few hundred dollars, the value of costume jewelry. Why? Because it's true. If I give you something worth $10,000, I say, can you watch this for me? And you say yes, you're accepting responsibility for a $10,000 item. If you're careless, you leave the door open, something happens to it, you have a liability for that amount. On the other hand, if I told you it's only worth a few hundred dollars, you only accepted liability for a few hundred dollars. So even though you were negligent, even though you were reckless, you left the door open, we can't go back to you, we can't ask you to pay for more than it's than the value that you were led to believe that it was that it was worth. So even though it's worth more, you'll only have to pay the value that you were told at the time you accepted responsibility. So it sounds like, in our case, the cake, he should be off the hook. He was told it was a cake. Cake costs $10, $15. That's all he should have to pay. The problem is, you have to go a bit further in the Talmud. And the Talmud talks about a slightly different case. What happens if we're not dealing with a neighbor, we're not dealing with a guardian? My neighbor comes to me and shows me, do you see my new jewelry? It's not really real. It's only worth a few hundred dollars, but what do you think of it? And he shows it to you. You happen to be angry at this neighbor, and you're in a bad mood. You take the jewelry, and you just throw it into the water. The neighbor says, what do? You say, listen, I was in a bad mood. I'll pay you a couple hundred bucks. The neighbor says, a couple hundred bucks? I told you it was costume jewelry, but it was all real. You just threw in a $50,000 necklace into the water. I want you to pay. So what would be the halacha in this case? In this case, the Talmud says you've got to pay the $50,000. Why? Because when I give you something to watch, what's your responsibility? Your responsibility is you accepted responsibility. You said, I will guard this for you. And implicit in that is that if you don't guard it, I'm going to pay you for that loss. So if I tell you it's only worth $300, that's your liability. On the other hand, someone comes over to you, takes your necklace and throws it in the water. They had no right to do that. It's a tort. In Hebrew, it's called a mazik. You have no business going ahead and damaging someone else's goods. So if you go ahead and you destroy someone else's item and then claim, oh, I thought it was fake. I didn't realize it was real. That's not a defense. Who asked you to go ahead and damage the other person's thing? You go ahead, you punch someone out, he ends up with $10,000 in medical bills. You can't say, oh, I thought it would only be $1,000, I didn't hit you that hard. Who asked you to hit? It's not a question of accepting response. So in that case, where you're a mazik, where you go ahead and you actively went ahead and destroyed something that belongs to someone else, then what you thought it was worth would not be a defense, and you'd have to pay the full amount. Going back to our case of the cake, what does that mean? Had you just been negligent, had you taken the cake on the flight, but at some point you just, you walked away to the other side of the plane, you watched the movie, you came back 3 hours later, it was gone. So there you'd be negligent. Negligence, you only pay what you were told it was worth. But in this case, where you took the cake, you threw it into the garbage, who asked you to throw a cake that didn't belong to you in the garbage? In that case, you're a mazik. In that case, you're actively destroying someone else's money. And in that case, you should have the complete liability. That being said, there's a technical problem. Who says he really had $10,000 in this cake? Now, normally, a person makes a reasonable claim. So, let's say it goes that you have a pyromaniac. He sets a house on fire. The owner, he gets caught. The owner says there was $300,000 worth of goods in the house. So, how do you prove it? Everything's gone. No pictures, no anything. Normally, we believe the victim. Because there's really, basically, it's not fair to the pyromaniac. So the moral of the story is don't go burn down other people's houses. That's the risk you run. But we believe the victim. He makes an oath. He's believed what's there. However, the Talmud says that's only when his claim is reasonable. You burn down a house and the guy says, I have, three computers. So if it's a reasonable claim, he's believed. However, if it's an extreme claim, it's something that it's just completely abnormal, then we don't have to take his word for it. So in this particular case, if he can somehow prove there were witnesses that saw him stuff the $10,000 in the cake, then there's what to talk about. Again, it's actually a machloikis, but there's what to talk about. But in a typical case where it's just taking his word for it, you have no obligation to take his word or believe him that he did something this extreme. So in that case, it would be very difficult to actually recover in a bezin.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's not the most important thing, but, you know, the way you described the story with the cake, and suppose somebody tells you to take ice cream, mm-hmm. you know, across the country, and there's a heat wave, mm-hmm. the ice cream helps. You're not allowed to throw the ice cream away, you know, because the person put diamonds in the ice cream, now you're responsible for
okay, excellent point. We changed around the case a little bit. You know, it's in the case of the ice cream, it's melted. Now, what's the argument? Let's go back. The case where you took the necklace, you thought it was costume jewelry, and you just threw it into the water. So we said, even though you thought it was worth $300, you still have full liability because who gave you the right to throw this in the water? That's true in the case of jewelry. If you have melted ice cream, then your job is to throw it in the garbage. And therefore, in that case, I would agree with you. In that case where you're completely justified in throwing it out, you're not doing anything wrong by throwing it out, so you had no way of knowing about the diamonds, you'd be off the hook.
Well, somebody doesn't need to carry cake. There's an assumption that, you know, they're not asking you to get whipped cream all over you and for cake to drip all over. And so
if it had it been dripping out, I'd agree with you. If you just had enough, you were tired, you're schlepping enough, you're frustrated, you're sitting in the airport for 4 hours, you just had enough. It's not your cake. It belongs to someone else. It may not be a very expensive item, but if it belongs to someone else, the fact that you're frustrated doesn't give you the right to dump it in the garbage. But had it been ice cream and had it been melting, you're completely right. That would be what the normal thing to do. It has no value, and you'd be justified.
But you replaced the cake. So even if he was dying, he's like, okay, I don't care. I want to.
Okay,
worth my,
great point.
My trouble, mm-hmm. you know, not to trouble with the cake on the plane. I'm going to spend the $20 when I get to Los Angeles.
The problem is like this. Let's say after the lecture, you know, you're hungry. Now the host is not around, and you know, cake. You know, you want real food. So when no one's looking, go into the refrigerator, you help yourself to a steak. With the intention, you're going to come back tomorrow and replace the steak.
Okay.
Now, at the end of the day, come tomorrow night, your host is not any richer or any poorer. He had a steak before, he has a steak after. But you don't have the right to steal an item, even if you're going to replace it later. So to the extent that this cake belongs to the brother, it's going to the sister. To go ahead and say, I'm going to destroy it because I will replace it, that's something which you don't have the right to take these liberties with other people's money. Now, had it been melted ice cream, that would be a different story.
Well, it's something illegal in the cake instead of the money.
Okay, well, actually, the way I heard the story was a trip to Israel. I didn't want to go there because then we have a completely separate issue. Because let's say you didn't just get frustrated and dump it in the garbage. Let's say you're on the plane, you're on El Al, and you got hungry or something, and you take a bite, and you see there are diamonds. Do you have an obligation to deliver the cake? Absolutely not. You don't have the right. Certainly not the obligation. Probably don't have the right to smuggle it through customs. So what does that mean? That means what you would have to do is just leave it on the plane. In which case, it's going to disappear. So in that case, you'd be very hard pressed to make the person pay because what's he supposed to do?
Was that cake taken across the customs?
What?
Was that cake taken across the customs? Or it was...
No, it was before... Well, once you made it through customs, you're ready. You're in Ben-Gurion. That's not the problem. The problem is he was still in the States, and he just threw it in the garbage in JFK.
But also you have an obligation to tell your shliach what you're asking him to do.
Correct. We are not justifying what the brother did. That's clearly wrong. That was a terrible tragedy a few years ago with boys in Japan who were unwittingly smuggled in things
was
terrible.
I'm saying $10,000. You're obligated to tell your shliach that there's not a cake. It's $10,000. Like you can't. That's a trick.
Well, who's suffering from the trick? In the case of a shliach, as long as he doesn't do anything reckless.
In my opinion, if you don't tell him the $10,000 in the cake, then it's his right to throw the cake away and replace with another cake. That's a reasonable thing to do.
As far as not watching it, Again, if I agree with you, if you don't disclose it and something happens, you're negligent, then we, as we mentioned before, you don't have that liability because you only accepted liability on a cake. But let's flip it around. Let's say you're the courier on the cake. You know it has $10,000 in it. I'm sitting next to you, and I get so annoyed with you, I take it and throw it in the garbage. Do I have a defense that I didn't know what its value is? We're saying no, because who asked me to get involved and take your cake and throw it in the garbage? The same way a total stranger wouldn't have that defense, the fact that you're also a courier doesn't release you of the obligations a total stranger would have. But two wrongs don't make a right.
Yeah,
and since
what should be reimbursing the person who did one of the wrongs?
The same way, if a third person, your seatmate, went ahead and took it and threw it out, he's liable simply because who asked you to throw out the other person's cake? The courier is not worse than that, and therefore, while the owner should have notified him, that doesn't give him the license to release him if he goes ahead and actively throws it out that he shouldn't have done.
So tonight I gave you a book to take back to somewhere in the yeshiva, right? And I'm whatever extremely wealthy, and I put $1 million inside this book, and it's meaningless to me because maybe I'm Sheldon Adelson, right? And you go lose the book.
No, losing, I'm off the hook.
Okay, you're going to work for me.
So if you need another reason not to take people's books and throw them in the garbage, this is it. Now, it's not a very likely reason, and I think the better reason not to throw a book in the garbage is it doesn't belong to you, and you have no right to take other people's money and damage it. But when you do that, you are running a risk, a very remote risk, perhaps, that there is $1 million hidden there.
There was a book by O. Henry about two women friends. One was poor, one was rich, and the poor one borrowed the rich one's necklace, diamond necklace.
Correct.
She lost it. And then what she did, she pawned her whole life, and she bought the new one, and she gave it to her, and 20 years later she meets her, and she says, oh, that was just custom jewelry. It wasn't real diamonds. She was paying her all along, all these years.
It's a nice way to save, you know, a retirement account.
Right.
But you know what? Let me jump on that case for a moment. Did this wealthy friend do the right thing? When if someone asks to borrow jewelry, and they think it's real, it's not. Do you have an obligation to tell them when they borrow it, by the way, you should know this is fake? Let's shift around the case slightly. It's your anniversary is coming up. You have to buy some juice, you know, buy a nice gift for your wife. Now, you're doing this cash is a little bit tight. So what you do is you go ahead, you find a place online, you buy a cheap gift. You then go ahead and find someone with a Tiffany's box. You put the gift in the box, and you present it to have a nice, beautiful anniversary present. Is there anything wrong with what you've done? By a show of hands, first we'll ask the man, and then we'll ask...
Very good idea.
I wouldn't try that.
Okay, actually, first we'll have the men whose wives are here answer the question, and then we'll have... Excellent. So your point is, it is gnevas das. You are misleading someone. Let me go through two situations of the Gemara, and then I'd like to revisit and really go through what the parameters of this concept are. Case number one in the Talmud. Fellow's a butcher. He has his meat, he has his animal, and there's a piece of meat that isn't kosher. There's a gitanasha, it's not. Now, so what does he do with it? He has his Gentile friend who's down the block. So he does. He sends him. He can't eat it for himself. He can't sell it to his regular clientele. So he sells it to the non-Jewish fellow down the block. What does he care? It's kosher. It's not kosher. He sends it to him as a gift. The Gemara says, that is Gnevas Das. You can't do that. Why? Because when this fellow receives the gift, everyone knows Jewish pastrami. You know how much Jewish pastrami costs? It's expensive stuff. When a Jewish butcher sends you a piece of meat, the presumption is that it's kosher. So this person who's not Jewish is going to say, wow, this butcher really likes me. He's sending me this expensive piece of meat. He's going to be fooled into thinking you're his great friend, where it's baloney. Really, this is something, well, baloney, no pun intended. Really, this was garbage. You had nothing to do with it. Instead of throwing in the garbage, you just gave it away as a gift. That is called Ganeva's Das. Literally, you're stealing his mind, you're fooling him. Now, what we see is really 2 points. First of all, we see the same way you're not allowed to fool a Jew, you're not allowed to fool someone who isn't Jewish. But more importantly, there's no money changing hands. You're not selling anything. You're not selling kosher meat for $15 a pound and really giving him horse meat. It's a gift. But the fact that he's going to think this is a valuable gift, this is an expensive gift, and in reality it's garbage, that is called Ganeva's Das. In addition, when the butcher sent the piece of meat, did he say kosher pastrami? He didn't say a word. He just sent the piece of meat. But if in the context of a Jewish butcher sending you a piece of meat, the natural presumption is this is kosher. So by doing that without disclosing, without telling him that this is not kosher, that is a violation of Ganeva's Das. Now, to jump a little bit, if a person is selling his car, selling his house, and there's a defect, if you don't disclose the defect, you didn't make any guarantees. You're not saying brand new. You're not saying perfect condition. You're just selling the car. You're just selling the property. But if you know there's a defect, there is an assumption. People who are buying things, they think that it's in good working condition. If you know there's an issue, even if you don't say anything, you don't represent that it's in good condition, but if that's the natural assumption, you're selling it, it's in good condition, then by not disclosing the defect, even though it's passive, you haven't said anything that isn't true. There's no lie involved. But this would violate Ganeva's Das. This is the first example in the Gemara. The Gemara, later on, has the following story. There was a rabbi that was traveling from one city to another. He was going, let's say, from Lakewood to New York. Now, coincidentally, there were another two rabbis that were coming, they were traveling the opposite direction. They were from New York, they were going towards Lakewood. And sure enough, they met as soon as this first rabbi left the city limits. Actually, it was all the way around. As the rabbi was about to arrive at his destination, as he sees two distinguished rabbis coming towards him, he said, wow, a welcoming committee. Thank you so much for coming to greet me. So the first rabbi said, yeah, I want to be perfectly honest with you. We happen to be on our way to Lakewood. We didn't know you were coming. Had we known you were coming, we may have greeted you, but we're really... This was completely unintentional. We did not mean to greet him. The other rabbi turns to the first one and said, what are you doing? You're making him feel bad. He thinks he has a whole welcoming committee. He thinks he's a very important person. You're bursting his bubble. You're telling him that, no, we're not coming to you. We happen to be traveling anyway. It's a coincidence. What are you doing? So let's think about this case for a minute. Who do you think is right? This first rabbi is being fooled. He thinks they're greeted. He has a welcoming committee. Reality, they weren't welcoming him. They happen to have been walking. Do you have an obligation to disclose this or not?
Well, they had no intention of fooling him.
Excellent. Excellent. So there are two reasons why they don't have to disclose. Number one is that there was no intent to fool. They were just traveling. The Gemara says, he jumped to his own wrong conclusions. Ganeva's Das is when you fool the person, not because you lie to him, but when a kosher butcher sends you a piece of meat, there is an implication that this is kosher. So by sending it, and not disclosing that it's not kosher, that violates Ganeva's Das. In contrast, traveling out of a city, what are you doing? You're just traveling. The fellow happens to meet you. You're not doing anything where there are no implications. He had no business jumping to this conclusion. And therefore, in that case, we say, there he fooled himself. And therefore, I don't have an obligation to go ahead and correct everyone else's mistake. I can't fool people, but if they have their own erroneous conclusions, I don't have to go ahead and educate them.
But if you're aware that he will fool himself through your step, through your actions, that it's his responsibility but it's through you. You are the instrument of him fooling himself.
Okay, don't excellent. You have an obligation of... Excellent. It depends what you mean by instrument. In the case of the leaving, what they point out is this rabbi who was traveling really had this conclusion that he jumped to, that there's a welcoming crowd, really wasn't warranted. Because he didn't call these two people and tell them, by the way, I'm coming, you know, I'd appreciate having a little welcoming committee. It was a total coincidence. So there's nothing, it wasn't the natural conclusion for him to jump to. On the other hand, when you're a butcher and you're sending meat, even though you haven't said anything, there, since the natural conclusion is that it's kosher, there you would have an obligation. So what that means is, that I can't do anything where I'm fooling, so where there's gneivas das, where someone's thinking that you're giving them a more expensive present than it really is. On the other hand, if they jump to conclusions on their own, there I don't have a proactive obligation to educate them, to burst their bubble, and in fact, I shouldn't. If this person thinks on his own that I'm a great friend of his, so once I have not violated gneivas das, why should I burst his bubble? Why should I make him feel bad? Why should I? He may as well live in this delusion that I'm his good friend as long as I'm not responsible for that perception. So, going back to our gift in the Tiffany's box, based on what we've learned until now, this is a clear case of gneivas das, because you are representing this is an expensive gift, when really it is a cheap, inexpensive present, and that would be gneivas das. Now that being said, there is some hope. There's hope. Many people know that Aaron HaKohen, that Aaron was the Kohen Gadol. He was the priest. He was Moses' brother. And one of the things that's said about him is that he was an Ohev Shalom V'Roidev Shalom. He always went ahead and tried to make peace between people. And when there was a fight, if there were two people who were involved in a dispute, they were angry at each other. Neither of them was ready to apologize. So he'd go over to one of the people involved in the dispute and say, you know what, I just spoke to your ex-friend. He really feels bad about this situation. He really wants to make up. Maybe you should just, you know, try to bump into him. And, you know, he wants to be your friend again. He'd then go over to the other person, tell him the same story. And that way, when the two of them met, they would somehow manage to repair the relationship. Why isn't that gneivas das? You're fooling the person. You're lying to them. The answer is, and this is what Knesset Gadol writes, that gneivas das, to fool someone, is a terrible thing. You want to go ahead, you want to pretend you're a friend, you're sending a cheap piece of meat, and you want to fool the person into thinking it's an expensive piece of meat. That's wrong, because you're misrepresenting the relationship, you're fooling him, can't do that. On the other hand, when there's a feud going on, when there's a battle, and you just, they're enemies, and you just want to tone it down, you want to stop this war and make up, they already, it is permitted for the greater good to go ahead and to do gneivas das, because you're not there, you're not trying to earn fake brownie points, you're trying to repair a relationship and prevent machlokes and fights from furthering. What that means is, I don't know what your relationship with your wife is. If you've hit rock bottom and there's a fight, and the only way to repair this relationship is to go ahead and to put it in the Tiffany's box, perhaps it will be permitted. But under normal circumstances, if you're just trying to go ahead and, you know, win cheap points, that clearly would be wrong. Now, it's an extra caveat. Even when there's a fight, I believe it's only permitted when there's no other option. Aaron HaKohen had no other way to create, to preserve or create peace other than telling each of the parties the other one really wants to make up. If you're stuck and you absolutely can't afford the more expensive gift, the only way to make up the relationship is with this gift. You probably have more serious issues, but then we can talk about this potential justification. But if you can go ahead and spend the money, you would just rather blow it on your new smartphone, then I don't think you can go ahead and try to use this as justification.
But in the instance that you're selling a pre-owned car or you're selling a home, and the car is going to be inspected by the person's inspector, and the home is going to be, you know, inspected by the inspector, do you have to give more information when you know an independent party is going to be reviewing it?
Okay, that's a great question. There are those that say if the norm is to inspect it, and had he done his normal due diligence, he should find it. There are opinions that say you do not need to disclose it. But if there is a hidden defect, which even a typical home inspection will not turn it up, as everyone knows, if your car, the air conditioning blows, you sell it during the winter. The heat goes, you sell it in the summer. So that kind of thing where it's possible for him to miss, there's an obligation to disclose it. Now, what you have to disclose, if you have a brand new car and there's anything wrong with it, so that's a defect that buyer doesn't expect, he's not accepting it, and there clearly there's an obligation to disclose it. On the other hand, if you have your 2008 Camry and it has, you know, a couple of dents or a couple of, you know, the transmission is not quite the way it used to be, that is normal and that's expected for a car of that age and that condition. You don't have to go ahead and give a 20-page list of all, but anyway, whatever's expected, whatever's typical is fine. It's when there's something more significant, and certainly if it's something which is a latent defect which he won't be noticed, there's a proactive obligation to come clean.
Can you simply tell the buyer or advertise it that it's being sold as is?
So as is itself, that's an interesting question. As is works if you don't know the condition, you don't know what's, and you just don't want to take the risk, you can sell it as is. If you know this thing's a lemon, the car is going to make it off the lot, down the block, and that's about it. Saying as is not a release. Because as is just means if you sell in good faith, and he discovers the next day there's something wrong, you have a defense. You bought it as is. But if you know there's a problem, then as is not sufficient to justify.
I guess it depends on the meaning that different people put on as is.
Correct. Used car salesmen have one definition, and the rest of us seem to have other definitions. That's unfortunately very, very true.
Everything works against you. One time, we were trying to buy a division from General Electric, you know, the online service.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Sunday morning, and like all the people who were, you know, the head of this division is like one of the five big divisions of GE, waiting in a conference room for us in some suburb of Washington. And we showed up, and they had all the books. We had a competing service. They had all the books, you know, on the table. And we said, how much do you want for the service? And they said, $25 million, about. I said, well, we can't open the books. You know, we have to leave because it's much more willing to pay. So just be gnevis das. We open the book because we want to find out how your service is working. And everyone down the alley, we left. And we're in the parking lot. This Gentile guy from GE came running into the parking lot and says, how much would we have to charge you so it wouldn't be gnevis das? It's in the $5 million neighborhood, so come back.
Okay. I didn't know gnevis das is such a good negotiating tactic. Okay. Good for you. You see? You follow the rules. Did the transaction work out at the end?
Yeah, it was one of the best transactions.
Okay. Excellent.
Question.
What?
I know a case where one from Jew sold the house to another from Jew. So the original owner was in the house for a while, and the plumbing leaked, and he was the kind of guy who would just put a Band-Aid on it. And he would have just continued putting Band-Aids on the pipes as long as he lived in the house. But suddenly he had to sell the house. So he sold the house, and the guy who bought it, you know, moved in and found out what the pipes were like, and he was very angry about it because he would never have repaired it that way, and he wanted them repaired properly. So now he was angry and resentful that he felt misled, but the guy who originally owned the house thought there was nothing wrong with it because had he lived there another 20 years, he would have kept putting Band-Aids on the pipes.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, it's a difficult situation, but what we would look at, as far as halacha is concerned, is not what the owner would do for himself, and not what the fact that he is the kind of laid-back person and he doesn't mind putting Band-Aids, you know, every day and changing it, doesn't give him the right to impose that attitude on a buyer. That being said, if a typical person in this house is not going to go ahead and rip out every pipe in the house because there is, you know, because the house is 50 years old. Typically, you go ahead and you deal with it on a time by time situation. So then the fact that the buyer is especially, you know, particular, he can't impose that on the seller. Both of them would really have an obligation. If they want to know what's right, you'd have to look at what a typical buyer and seller do. You'd have, obviously, the size of the house is going to make a difference. You're buying an expensive mansion, you have higher standards than you're buying you know, a hut in a slum. But you'd have to look at what the normal expectations on the market are. Now, I'll end off with one interesting. This is a Mishnah, actually, that quotes a particular situation. A person was selling fruit. So the Mishnah says that if you have your fruits, some of the fruits are better quality, some of them are rotting. So the halakha is, what if you want to go ahead and just take out all the rotting ones, that's fine. But if you take skim off all the rotting fruits from the top, and you leave the bottom the way it is, that is another example of Gnevas Das. Now that sounds pretty obvious. When you have a Mishnah, the general rules, when there's a Mishnah telling, it's teaching us something. So the decisors, the Mepharshims, that discuss, that explain the Gemara, have different theories what the case is talking about. And it's something which is extremely relevant today. The Dibros Moshe explains that the case is, you have the fruits, you have the thing of fruits, the bottom is, you know, some are lower quality, you just skim off the bad ones from the top. Dibros Moshe says, buyers are not fools. When they come into your store, they're going to come in, they're going to see it. Before they buy it, they're going to dig a little deeper. They're going to find all the rotting fruits. And they're going to negotiate with you. And at the end of the day, they're going to pay you the fair price. What's the problem? The problem is, why did they come into your store? Because they see in the window this pile of beautiful fruits. They say, wow, this is what I've been looking for, wonderful quality fruits. Therefore, the Dibros Moshe writes, even though at the end of the day when they purchase it, they'll know good and well what they're getting, it'll be the fair price, the very fact that you lured them in with this false pretense, that would be Gnevas Das as well. Now today that's known as bait and switch. You go ahead, you advertise goods, and when they come, oh, I'm sorry, we just sold the last one, but I have something else, it's better, it's a few dollars more, and you know better than I do how the game works. So Dibros Moshe says that is Gnevas Das. You're not the actual sale. When it comes time for the purchase, they know what they're doing, but the very fact that you lured them in, you tricked them into looking at it, that would be Gnevas Das. Another suggestion is, it's true the customer will realize that things aren't quite the way, you know, that something's wrong. The fruits on the bottom, the top is really not indicative of the overall quality. But he won't imagine how bad it really is. I actually had a friend who bought a used car. It was this is going back about 17, 18 years ago. It was one of the Grand Marquis, you know, those big cars. When he bought the car, the used car salesman was a somewhat honest person. And the odometer said it had 30,000 miles on it. But when he bought it, the salesman said, listen, I've been in the business long enough. Something's not right. This car is used more than 30,000 miles. I'm going to sell it to you as if it had 70,000 miles on it. And that way, I think that's the fair thing to do. That's what he did. The fellow bought the car, paid for it. He registered the title. And when he got the title back from the DMV, what he discovered was the miles were not turned back. Back then, the American cars went until 99,000 miles. They went back, it then started back at zero. The car had 130,000 miles on it. Now, in this case, the seller disclosed that $30,000 was probably not accurate. But it's still Gnevas Das, because although the buyer knew it wasn't 30,000, in no way in the world he imagined it was 130,000. So that would be a case of Gnevas Das, where just simply the fact that he would never think that it was so extreme, that would be Gnevas Das as well. Okay. Correct.
Is this sale,
it was on the title. The seller.
Revocable?
Yes. If you represent, not from Gnevas Das per se is not grounds to undo the sale, but there's a related concept of mekach tois, that you sell someone comes into the store to buy apples, you give him oranges, that he can undo the deal. If you come in and to buy a car that has 30,000 miles or even 70, and in fact it has $130,000, 30,000 miles, he's not delivering what he promised. The deal was, I'll pay you $5,000 for car X. If it's materially different, he hasn't done his part of the bargain. You have every right to undo the deal and get your money back. Okay, we are out of time. We had another couple.
What was that solution in the first case?
The what?
The first case with the deal with the land. Yeah. You never gave us that solution. What happened?
With the land.
With the land that the guy was trying to.
Oh, he walked away. He didn't. He went ahead. He cut a deal with the person, but to go ahead and to force the person and to seize it through eminent domain would be Lo Yisachmud. And he.
But he cut a deal at the end.
We're Jewish. We always at the end. Can always. It's just a question of what the price point was.
We all hear about the mistakes made by companies,
mm-hmm.
and that people take advantage of them.
So I'll just tell you because we are being recorded. There was a famous story with El Al.
There
was
right.
Dan. Well, I actually gave a shiur about it shortly afterwards, and. I was not for it. I think the bottom line, the shiur was for an hour, but the bottom line is, if you see that someone makes a mistake, what you should be doing is calling up the person making the mistake and warning him. You're going to lose your shirt if you don't correct the mistake. To go ahead and tweet it out to everyone, chaparayim, grab it before they notice, I don't think is the right thing to do. Someone was kind enough to forward the shiur to Dan.
What about purchasing the
He posted it on his blog. The result was not pretty. So we'll leave it at that for now.
I can buy the tickets, the cheap tickets that I was selling you. Like,
yes. Okay, we're way over time. I want to thank everyone for listening. I think the one message perhaps is that everyone knows that Judaism has a lot to say about Shabbos, about keeping kosher. But the fact, dinim mamoners, or when people are involved in business, there is just as much. To their halachos, and it's important. When a person is engaged in business, supporting a family is something of tremendous importance. But when a person takes these halachos seriously, then he's changing his job as just a way to pay for the newer car, the newest gadget, the bigger house, into a way to serve Hashem by applying these rules and really using them as your guiding principles throughout your business. Thank you for listening.
Just one quick. And that is that, you know, since all of us are involved in our personal affairs and these kinds of questions come up, and very often the issues involved are not recognizable to one who hasn't been trained in this area. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could suggest a strategy that could help one to become more aware of gray areas that need further scrutiny.
Invite me back. Seriously, today there are a lot of resources available. There's the organization that I'm involved with, Business Halacha, has a website, businesshalacha.com. There's a wealth of material, written material, of lectures about these areas, and everyone hopefully has a connection to their rabbi, to their synagogue, and it's something which I think should be explored. Thank you.
On everyone's behalf, I would like to extend to you a very, very heartfelt our gratitude to you. By the way, I will add one little suggestion to add to what Rabbi Marburger said. Getting a hold of the Art Scroll publication, Business Halacha, this is my plug, will really give you some very insight into a lot of the different financial arenas. So I happen to, after it was published, I bought a copy. And I had a hard time putting it down. It's like fascinating reading. Business Halacha by Artko. At this point, I want to thank you again. We're very, very grateful. I also would like to thank our hosts, Richie and Wendy. Three points. Number one, Richie and Wendy invite everybody to join them for the wonderful refreshments that they prepared. On the refreshment table, number two, you will find Hot Off the Press. Information about our next scheduled lecture for 1 week right after Pesach. We've lined up a wonderful speaker. You'll see the info on there, as well as the schedule. We have Passover classes about how to do your home, how to run a Seder, how to go to Insights, other stuff happening. So there's a purple flyer on the table in the back. And a final announcement is in 5 minutes. Especially with the need that one gentleman has to say Kaddish tonight. On the Yahrzeit, we're going to have a minyan right here for Myers in 5 minutes from now. Have a safe trip home. Have a very good, healthy holiday, wonderful Pesach. Yes, you come.
Okay.
Great, thanks.